Yeah, exactly. I'm like, I know there's the pellets. This is my life now. Kill me.
Hello and welcome to Up, Up, Down, Down, the show about what has gone, is going, and will go horribly wrong in the games industry. With us today are Nigel Brook, a 15-year veteran in the games industry, having worked for Radical Games and Activision, is now co-founder at Steam Clock Software.
Hello.
And Matt Kump, a designer on the much-loved but ill-fated massively multiplayer game Glitch, is now working on a new game at Rocket Chicken Interactive.
Hi.
So our topic today is in-app purchase, the good, the bad, the ugly, probably mostly bad and ugly, given the bias of those of us who are on the team.
Bias?
Bias. Yeah, we're not biased at all. And coming
except
from
against the, in-app purchases, except, we're biased against that.
Oh, right, that one thing.
Yeah, yeah. I think we're biased in that although all of us have some involvement or familiarity with the games industry, we are also part of the iOS and Apple ecosystem as well. And so we've seen the changes that have come into that market since in-app purchase came in and first seemed like a really exciting thing. Oh, this is a great new way that we can potentially make money and have our games that we're working on, our apps that we're working on, be successful and profitable. And then we've seen all the interesting things people have done with it. So I think an interesting way to start might be for Matt to tell us a little bit of the story of Glitch, which is the game that you were working on at Tiny Speck, and how that related to in-app purchase.
Sure. So Glitch was a massively multiplayer game that was started in 2009, shut down in December of 2012. Rest in peace. But it's primary revenue model was essentially what you could equate to in-app purchases and premium currency. So the way that Glitch made money was through buying credits, which you could then use to pay for special outfits, special items for your house, and the like, more in-game content for this massively multiplayer world. And for the most part, that seems like a pretty reasonable strategy. You could buy credits outright. You could sign up for a subscription. It's a pretty tried and tested model. But what you can find is if you aren't really reaching your market, and it's a market that doesn't have a lot of experience with those types of situations, it might not work out for you in the long run. And there's obviously a lot more to it than that. But for the brief story, that's kind of how it went at Glitch.
Yeah, my perception of it as someone who didn't get a chance to play the game, I'm one of those, oh, well, I'll wait until the final, the bugs have been worked out, and then I never got a chance to play it. But a lot of my friends here in Vancouver got a chance to check it out, and I heard some positive things, and it seemed like there's definitely something worth seeing there when it was running. Mm-hmm. But the perception I got was that Glitch was trying to make this free-to-play business model of doing something that's really creative and interesting instead of the standard just copying a game and making you pay to win. And they're trying to, the team was trying to get around that tendency, and it was sad to see it not come to fruition. So
now here's one question. I also haven't played Glitch at all, though. As with Alan, I sort of followed it when it was in development. Is the in-app purchases, were they in the like game effect kind of model? Like it sounds from the way you're talking about, there were maybe more in the Team Fortress 2 hats kind of model of that the in-app purchases were not things that change the nature of the game much, but more things that, people show off or something like that. Is that an accurate characterization or?
Yeah, that's definitely what it was. Glitch was primarily a game about community and sharing, and not so much about gameplay in the sense of platformer or anything like that. I mean, it was technically a platformer in that you jumped on platforms, but the majority of what made it great was how community interacted with each other. And one way that you can really express yourself to the community is through your self-expression, through your house, through your personal, how you look and all that kind of stuff. And people love that. Like, the housing aspect was a major improvement to Glitch when we launched it after the second beta, which is a whole nother topic. But yeah, it was just buying things to express yourself rather than change the way the game works.
And I think most people would agree that that's the quote-unquote good type of in-app purchase.
Sure.
You know, this something that people can buy if they want to. They don't have to, and it doesn't affect the gameplay. Now, in the consequence of Glitch, maybe the gameplay, like what exactly quote-unquote is gameplay or what quote-unquote winning is maybe poorly defined. But the example of Team Fortress 2 is one of those things where I saw the game go free, and it was something that I had paid for, and my initial reaction was, what are they doing messing with my thing? And you know, now they're going to try and gamify it, and well, that isn't a game, but you know, monetize it with all these extra weapons and stuff. But it ended up being much more of a hey, if people enjoy paying for this, they can, and they seem to have done pretty well on that. But that seems to be less and less of the approach that people are taking with in-app purchase nowadays.
Team Fortress 2 is also in a really unusual situation in that respect, that the game was already basically paid for, right? Like, they didn't have to fund the development with hats. Presumably the hats now are suitable to fund the ongoing maintenance costs of Team Fortress 2, but that's way less than what it cost them to originally develop the game. And I think that's sort of an issue with the model of not giving people any new gameplay with their in-app purchases, that you know, you have that issue of it's more like a tip jar than it is that you're selling someone something, and that's going to make people in some cases less likely to chip in. Like, for me, I find the sweet spot of in-app purchase to be sort of the next level up of where you know you can get more of the game for your money. That's the way that sort of most of the console in-app purchase equivalent, which are like the DLC options, work, right? Is you're not paying for an item that you're going to use in game in some way in the regular gameplay. You're playing for new levels or new content that's, you know, that's sort of more of the same for people that really enjoyed what was there before. And that, like, that's something where it's a very clear economic transaction there, right? You're selling something to people.
Right. And I think a lot of that actually comes down to the affordance of the console itself. You can't really just interrupt somebody's gameplay as they're in the middle of a console game where you've taken the time to sit down, grab your controller, you're having a very direct experience, kill them and say, hey, you need to either wait an hour to keep playing, or you can pay $6 for 5,000 gems to regen your health.
That would be awesome. Yeah. I'm sure that Sony's terms and conditions for the console games actually prohibit that. Otherwise, we maybe would see that.
Possibly. Yeah, I mean, particularly with, like, PSN and Xbox Live titles, that could be a thing, but they would also just get totally ragged from reviews, whereas games that do that on iOS don't, because if it says, hey, you have to wait an hour, you can't keep playing, you're playing on your phone anyway, it's not a big deal. You just change to a different app or a different game real quick, or go about what you were supposed to be doing instead of playing games at work. Whereas on the console, I mean, it's such a dedicated experience. It's really tough to kind of break through that barrier and be like, hey, are you going to keep playing if we make you wait an hour? No? Oh, darn.
Well, on consoles, it's also, there is not much of a free-to-play experience on the consoles. Like, maybe Xbox Live, I'm PS3 guy, but maybe Xbox Live has some of those games. I've never noticed any free-to-play games on any of the consoles that monetize with in-app purchase.
I don't think there is. I certainly haven't heard of any, or at least if there have been any, they haven't been successful enough to kind of rise above the noise and hear about them if you're not a player of those games. Like, you, so many of them, you're paying up front a significant amount for the game that there'd just be a mutiny with some of that stuff. Like, I mean, people get annoyed enough by things like, oh, well, you know, you get this code to unlock the DLC with the first purchase of the game, but if you're buying a used game, you have to pay again for it in order to unlock something. Like the Catwoman missions in Arkham City, I think, were like that, right? That there was a redemption code in the box, and then if you weren't the first purchaser, if you got it on the used market, you just had to pay again for it. And that sort of thing people get annoyed enough at. The amount of nerd rage that would be leashed on people if they pulled the kind of stunts that, like Candy Crush and stuff like that, where they're actually making you pay in order to even keep playing at all, would just be unimaginable.
Is there any reason they, like, there would be outrage because you have to pay up front, but is there any reason that, is it in the console maker's best interest to keep the consoles a world where you do expect to have that transaction where you pay $60 and then you get a game and yeah, maybe there's some DLCs or extra codes, but that this idea of free to play and then, you know, paying to win or paying for time just never comes into that world? Or are we going to see maybe a desperate player, Nintendo, maybe Microsoft, I don't know, say, you know what, like, let's experiment with this and just have something that is on Xbox Live and it's a headline title, maybe get one of these, you know, franchises like, yeah, Halo 5, it's free to play, but you can buy hats or what have you.
I think potentially we could see an experiment like that. Again, I go back to the idea of the console as an experience. Doesn't really cater super well to that, because of at least existing markets for console games. They would just kind of get really upset with it and they would see right through all the nonsense. Like, I'm sure if it was, I don't know if you could fund a game purely on hats, at least a AAA title. But for example, like the markets that actually do play Candy Crush and stuff like that, while there might actually be some real gamers in there, they know what they're getting into, just because the market's been so saturated with that kind of thing. So I'm not sure, like, I could maybe see Nintendo trying that, especially right now, because they'll try anything, probably. But it's hard to see it working.
I think that makes a lot of sense. Let's work our way up a little bit, because we talked just to kind of set the scene. So we have the, you know, maybe four levels of in-app purchase of content that you could buy. So the first being sort of bling, as Nigel put it, the hats, the things that don't have gameplay effect, mm-hmm. things that are just nice to have, but don't do anything, so to speak. There's the next level, which is what we see in the console world, which is DLC, new game mechanics, content levels, and that kind of stuff. And you would also categorize something like letterpress this way. You know, we get this game where you can play against one person for free. You want to play against multiple people at the same time, it's 99 cents. And I think nowadays, you know, there's some backlash against console DLC when it first came around. Now people are pretty happy with those two, as, yeah, maybe there's some downsides to them, but they're pretty reasonable ways to unlock functionality in games. It's when we get to the sort of pay to win or pay for time world where there tends to be some really opposite incentives. The people who are making the game are not necessarily incentivized to make a good game. And I think that's where a lot of the anger and resentment starts to come in.
I do think even pay to win, you can do it better and worse. Like the pay to time ones, the pay for time ones, I find just kind of inexcusable. Like that seems really mercenary to me. Pay to win, I don't think is necessarily evil. I've been playing a fair bit of Plants vs. Zombies 2 the last little while, which I was a fan of the first one. I was sort of nervous about the second one because of their move to free with in-app purchases. But the way they've done it, it's got some of the sort of unpleasant consumables aspect of it, but the things that you really want to purchase are the couple of plants that they've held back, which are all pretty nice plants, but ultimately you really only have to spend like $10 or so and you've got all of those. And looking at it this way of like, would I have paid $10 for the game if all those plants had just been in it and that was their only business model? Yeah, probably I would have. And I'm good enough at the game that I don't need the extra grindy, like purchasing coins and using them to purchase special moves thing. And, you know, I'm not happy about the fact that they're sort of soaking people that aren't as good at the game that way. But, you know, people know what they're getting into with this stuff. I feel like something like that, you can play it and feel good about it because you can play the game effectively without paying for stuff and you're getting the whole gaming experience and you're paying for a little bit extra. The ones with the pay for time, like those just, those frustrate me so much. Even the fact that they exist at all, that, that there's this, like, you know, you're playing the game and it says like, hey, if you want to keep playing now, you've got to pay for it. Like that, that just totally frustrates me.
I would be inclined to say the pay for time model, this idea that, you know, they encourage you to want to play the game, but certain things will take longer and longer. Now, Tiny Tower is the one that I played the most that was like this, and it sort of triggered that thing in my brain that was like, oh my God, this is just like pure evil, and the people who made this are bad and they should feel bad. Was this like, oh, you do a thing and it's like, oh, you can do it every 60 seconds. Oh, okay, that's cool. I'll wait 60 seconds. And it's like, oh, like 3 minutes and then 8 minutes and then 45 minutes and then 2 hours and then 8 hours. And eventually it's just exponential. So in order to actually feed the fun that you're having, and often to make sure that your tower doesn't die or your cat doesn't die or, you know, whatever thing that you've built up doesn't get lost, you have to pay this thing. And I would probably go as far as to say that Apple should ban that game mechanic. And I don't know what the practical consequences are, how they would go about doing that, but I think the world would just be a better place.
Well, it's like a drug dealer giving you your first hit for free.
Exactly.
And it gets employed all the time. I mean, a lot of these just puzzle games and stuff start out pretty easy and colorful and addictive and rewarding and like, yeah, look, you're doing great. 10 levels. Wow, fantastic. Level 11. Oh, wait, the difficulty curve just shot way up. Suddenly you're out of moves and okay, see you in an hour, or you can pay right now and we'll put you back in the game, and then you're already hooked. And now the next time, well, now you gotta wait 2 hours and you gotta keep paying in order to keep playing, or time. And it's really just a balance of those two. If you have money, then you can pay money, but that's pretty exploitative of somebody's addiction, to put it loosely. Or if you have time, same thing.
Did either of you guys read that story that was, I think it was the New York Times, about a guy who was like number one in the world on this Clash of Clans thing? It was linked on Daring Fireball.
Oh, yeah, and was running like 8 or 10 accounts that had been turned over to him from other people in his clan or something like that.
And he could sacrifice other accounts to feed his. And,
yeah.
5 iPads in the shower.
Yeah, literally. Like, he's literally bringing iPads in the shower with like protective, like, bags around them so that he can try to not die, and really psychologically, it's not lose all this stuff that he's built up and all this time that he spent. And like, he found a rich patron to fund it, his ability to keep like not dying in the game and not losing his position. Like, I didn't really say how much money was involved, but it seemed like it was, you know, at least $10,000, but like tens of thousands potentially putting to this game.
At least 5 iPads. So just an app. Well,
yeah, exactly.
Do either of you know anything about what the mechanics of Clash of Clans actually are? Like, I've never seen it played. Like, it's one of those things where just the concept of it seems kind of skin crawling to me, in that, like, you know, old ladies pouring all their money into the one-armed bandit kind of way. Do either of you actually know anything about what the mechanics of that game are?
I saw Jeremy demonstrated at Steam Clock. He got into it for a couple weeks a few months ago, and my understanding of it, and from reading about it and seeing what he was doing, is that you build up this little town and then you go away, because you can't play that game 24 hours a day unless you have iPads in the shower. And so while you're away, other people will come and destroy the things that you built, and then you get back, and then, you know, you can build it up again and you can destroy other people's stuff. And I say destroy, maybe it's steal or pillage. It's probably put in the context of pillaging. But that's the core gameplay mechanic, is let you spend time making something you like and then ransom it.
Right. And what you can do is you can pay with gold or gems. I think it's most likely gems, to actually put a shield around your base for a time period, so that people can't actually do that. And then you kind of get hooked on that. But in order to get those gems, you either need to do a lot of that yourself, or you need to pay money. So it's, in essence, it's not pay to play, but it's pay to play conveniently.
So it's sort of like a mix of the pay for time and pay to win models.
Right. You couldn't, like, they actually still have various limitations on, like, you can only use one shield a week, or I forget what the number is, things like that. So it's not completely overpowered to people who just pay all the time. Like with the guy who was number one, he couldn't just invest money. He had to invest time. So it's not like inherently evil. They're just trying to make as much money as they can while trying to make a decent game. But it's still, yeah, you can still pay to not really play a game while still being successful in a game.
The point of trying to make the best game that they can, I think, is an interesting one, because to me, that's one of the things that bothers me about this style of design is, you know, there's sort of a moral argument from the analogy to drug dealing or analogy to casino gambling, where it's like, this is, you know, they're preying on people in some way. And I'm sympathetic to that argument, but for the same reason that, you know, I think there are arguments why we shouldn't like outlaw casinos and why we should maybe consider drug legalization and stuff like that. I wouldn't be entirely comfortable with the position that Alan took earlier of we need to ban these outright. What really I think bothers me the most about these as a gamer is how much this stuff kind of distorts the game design and makes the game design about things other than making a fun game, even if the makers go into it with good intentions of like, oh, we want to make something that's fun. The like focus on, okay, what are the metrics? What are the revenue per user? What particular blocks that we put in place that we need to pay people, make people pay to get around are bringing the most into the game. Like it distorts the game design. It ends up making these games that I think just aren't very fun in a lot of ways. And, you know, that's what keeps me away from the games the most is that aspect of it. That just like, there's nothing there compared to a game that has like a beginning and a middle and an end and an arc to it. And you feel like you're paying to see someone's attempt at making something great. And I get that feeling a lot more from conventional games than I do from these kinds of things. And you know, it doesn't bother me that other people are enjoying that, but I worry that that's time and money being stolen from things that I think are more worthwhile. And like, maybe that makes me a bit of an old fogey in the vein of someone complaining about how television is going to kill books or how, you know, how any new art form is going to destroy an old art form. But
that, wait, you're calling these games an art form?
Yeah.
Stop right there.
Yeah. Okay. Art, I don't know if art form is the right word. Media maybe is a better term than art form. They're definitely entertainment, whether they're art or not. And old forms of entertainment have always been threatened by newer forms of entertainment. And there's always a certain contingent of fans of the old form of entertainment that, you know, want to shake their cane at the kids and tell them to get off their lawn.
Yeah, and I think that that's something that historically, obviously, is always true, but this is unusual in that the new form of entertainment's fundamental business model is that the worse the game is, the more money they make.
Yeah, in a sense, it definitely is.
I don't know if it's the worse the game is. I think they're optimizing for different things. They're optimizing for revenue very specifically and with very detailed analytics and analysis turned to that problem of like, how can we soak the most money out of people? And it turns out that that grindy stuff is what does it. And sort of doing the same thing over and over, putting up these very artificial gates that keeps people playing a lot more effectively than like joy and wonder and the sort of emotions that, you know, that I feel like you can get out of some really good, polished gaming experiences.
I think the word experiences is really good. I guess when I say like they're making games that aren't great games anymore, and the worse of a game you make, the more this is employed, the worse games seem to get. I think it's because of just the experiences that can be possibly had out of these. And with a lot of them, like it's a hyper repetitive experience with no true reward or self-realization of any sort of concept. It's just, how can I release some dopamine? I can beat this level. Okay, great. And that's pretty much all it is. Whereas, like with something like Clash of Clans or Supercell's new game, Boom Beach, they do this. It's similar to Clash of Clans in its format of player versus player and its style and how it makes money, but it's much less dependent on that. It's got a lot more gameplay balance to it, and they actually made something that is enjoyable and competitive. Whereas like 20 of the top 25 grossing games are just pure time sinks, and not really challenging or creatively freeing at all.
So 20 of the top 25 grossing games are not pure time sinks. You mentioned Nigel was looking at the stats today, and what did you find as far as the top grossing games?
The only paid ones that I could find in the top 50 were Minecraft Pocket Edition and Grand Theft Auto San Andreas.
Yeah.
Everything else in the top 50 is like basically you click on it and it's the, you know, I'll read you the in-app purchase list for Clash of Clans.
Yeah.
Pile of gems, $4.99. Bag of gems, $9.99. Sack of gems, $19.99. Box of gems, $49.99. Chest of gems, $99.99. And like basically, if you just go down like the list, clicking on all of them, you basically get that same list with like different containers and different units of money substituted in.
Yeah,
and that's the top 50 right there.
Yeah, I was literally just looking at this yesterday and this morning too, like because I wanted to see if that was the case. And sure enough, in top grossing of the 25 free ones in top grossing, only two of them don't use premium currencies, and that's Candy Crush Saga and Pet Rescue Saga, both by King, and they just both use the buy moves or buy more lives.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's Minecraft, which I mean. It's up there for its own reasons.
Yeah, I'm so like, although I have problems with Minecraft, and I'm sure we'll have another episode at some point where I get to rant about that a little bit. Man, am I glad to see it up there, because that just gives me such hope that like there's at least some people that care about the same kind of things in these games that I do.
It's like, how do you break the top 50 grossing as a mobile developer, which is really something that every mobile game developer seems like they have to deal with? How can we make our game get up there other than going premium currency and free? You pretty much have to have a brand that's already really popular, and that's just not the case for 99.9% of indie developers.
And I'm not even sure that a brand that's popular is necessarily good enough anymore, because yeah, Minecraft's up there, but like I was talking about Plants vs. Zombies 2, it's languishing down in like the 80s or something like that. And I think it's a pretty good game as those things go.
Yeah.
And it's got in-app purchases, but it's way less exploitive than most of them, mm-hmm. which is damning with pretty faint praise. But yeah, they can't break the top 50 with that.
Yeah, you have to, the Minecraft and Grand Theft Auto are like monster franchises, two of the most successful games ever. And Grand Theft Auto is like top 50-ish. That's the praise it gets for all that work.
Yeah.
And then there's hundreds of, thousands, tens of thousands of high budget, like sort of the equivalent of what a AAA game would be on a console that are not in that list. You know, there's the EA's games. And then there's also, you know, indie, like not quite AAA, but what, you know, going for that AAA things. If either of you guys saw Republic, which was a kickstarted game that was going for that, we're a AAA thing. And then like it launched and I haven't been watching. I haven't figured out where they are in the ranks, but they're definitely not in the top 100 top grossing. So
yeah,
the thing that makes me wonder is, because Matt, you sort of mentioned these games are obviously driving this bad incentives that drive people to make games that are just not good. They're games that consume time and release endorphins, but don't actually, or dopamine. But don't actually contribute anything to the greater canon of games. But at the same time, we've had games coming out in the last few years, like Bioshock Infinite or The Last of Us or Journey, which are competitive as some of the most remarkable games of all time. And so do you think that's sort of a last gasp? Or do you think that it's just split where there's more people playing games than there used to be playing these dumb games, and they're not actually necessarily taking revenue opportunity from the games that are good?
Yeah, I think it's definitely the latter, at least in the current spectrum of things. just because of who owns the thing that the game is on. The great games that come out for PC and console are played by people who play on PC and console. The great, I use great loosely in that it's up there. The successful games that come out on iOS, Android, just those two, never mind the other ones, are up there because almost everybody's got one of those phones, at least in the Western world, and they like to kill time on them. So how do they do it? They put a colorful game up there for free, get you start playing, and then you'll start paying. And it's not about making amazing experiences on it, because you're not usually going to devote a lot of time and attention to your phone, whereas the people who are playing games are expecting that. They know what they're doing. Even new gamers know what they're getting into, and it's dedicated to that experience.
I'll contrast that to the early days of the iPhone and the iPad, and we had game experiences that we'd never seen before, things that involved the touch and the games like Osmos that were like kind of immersive for the technology that were around at the time. And that seems to, even if on the consoles, because they aren't competing directly with these in-app purchase click fests, the AAA amazing storyline console games are getting made, but the really like thoughtful, different games on iOS aren't necessarily, I mean, they're either not being made or it's hard to find them. And I guess the thing that makes me wonder is like, is this status quo in Apple's best interest?
I think that there are good games being made on iOS, and you can find some of them if you look at the top paid versus the top grossing. If you're just sort of like, hey, where could I possibly find something like that? Like when I was looking through the top grossing to sort of collect the evidence against these games, you look at the top paid and there's plenty of stuff in there that I would consider to be good. I mean, Minecraft squatting at the top of that, I think that's definitely pretty positive. Cut the Rope, the new Cut the Rope one is up there, which I haven't played Cut the Rope 2, but certainly Cut the Rope 1 I would consider a good game. Both of the Room games are up there right now, which I've only played the first one of, but it was fantastic as a puzzler. There's a bunch of the Toca Boca games up there, which are fantastic as a parent. Like those are both like games that kids really like and ones that you don't feel too bad about them playing because they're fairly family friendly kind of games and they don't do lots of scuzzy things. Like so many of the kids games that are out there are sort of banging the in-app purchase drum to try and get money out of there. And the Toca Boca guys, as far as I know, don't have any in-app purchase in any of their games. So, the stuff's there. I worry about the sort of opportunity cost more than the, is this taking players away from the good games? I think probably not. Like gamers are gamers. People that are sort of dedicated to gaming are going to seek out the more interesting experiences. And a lot of the people that are bringing these top are people that they're casual gamers, right? They're people that enjoy gaming's experience, but don't have it define them at all. And, probably those people aren't necessarily going to be seeking out the deeper experiences. But like I said, there's this opportunity cost of all of the talent that's going into making those games is not going into making games that I'd like better. And there's probably some good games that didn't get made because the developers are like, well, if we just make a Clash of Clans clone, we'll do better with that than we will with a really unique gaming experience.
Zynga.
I don't know that Zynga ever had it in them to make really high quality games.
I don't know. Was Farmville a ripoff of something? Like at the time, I didn't think it was, but now everything is either that I've seen out of Zynga, who last I heard were their stock was crashing and their CEO quit and they were kind of getting what they deserved. And then they haven't been in the news for the last, I guess, year or so. I'm not sure if I'm sure they still exist, but have they kind of given up or?
I heard loosely through the grapevine that they're working on games instead of what they used to do. So in that sense, maybe they're just keeping quiet so they can try and let the kind of bad feelings wash away until they can go, hey, look, we're not really evil anymore. Please play this. But we'll see if that's actually the case. Cause yeah, it's been really quiet.
There's always a danger with these kind of grindy gameplay styles of people just en masse getting kind of sick of it and giving up on that. And that's something I feel like has happened to Zynga a lot. Like, Draw Something is kind of the classic example of that, right? Of like, you know, zero to like tens of millions of users in a couple months, and then Zynga bought them, and then, you know, back down to like hundreds of thousands to millions of users in almost as short an amount of time, right? Where everyone was playing it for a while, and then everyone just kind of got sick of it at the same time and stopped playing it. And I think the chances of people like getting sick of that style of grindy game as a whole is pretty slim. And, you know, casinos are sort of the great counterexample to that, of if people were going to get sick of grindy gameplay, like, casinos would have gone out of business a long time ago. But certainly people get sick of individual games quite frequently. I, you know, like I said, I don't play a lot of these grindy kind of games, but my wife was heavily into both Candy Crush and The Simpsons Tapped Out, though I explicitly forbade her to ever buy any in-app purchases. And fortunately, she trusts my game sense at least enough to listen to me on that. And I was talking to her about the other day, you know, getting ready for this, and was like, hey, are you still playing those at all? And she's like, no, I just kind of got sick of them. Like, they're just kind of the same thing over and over again and got boring. And so she, you know, she played them obsessively for several months, and then just, you know, one day it was just like, nope, had enough, delete. And if enough people do that to your game at the same time, you can crash pretty hard. And I think that's a lot of what happened to Zynga.
Why don't we do a sponsor?
Yeah, sounds good.
So our sponsor this episode is an app called Party Monster. Have you guys heard of this?
Yeah, I've heard of it.
Okay, it's very cool. So Party Monster is a queuing DJ app for parties and road trips. It's universal. It works on iPhone and iPad, and it works with the music you already have synced to your device from iTunes. Most importantly, it refuses to play Nickelback.
What?
Yes, I know. Now, I don't know if either of you offended about that. I have some inside information that probably you're not, but just in case, you might want to keep that in mind if you're going to buy the app. You can get it for only $1.99. It's on the App Store, and you can visit steamclock.com/partymonster. To get your copy now. They're going fast. So
limited.
It's limited quantities.
How much would 1,000 gems in the app cost?
That's a good question. Of course, in Party Monster, there is a large variety of gems. You can get buckets, crates, garbage cans worth of gems. There's many available. They don't actually do anything, but they're all available in the app, in app purchase for you.
Nice.
When we were developing Party Monster, we did actually debate whether or not we should make enabling Nickelback playback an in-app purchase.
That's true. We did.
Yeah. We decided against it because we thought it might be a little too scummy, but it was on the table for a while there.
I think if it had been just up to me, I probably would have done it. But Nigel, I think rightly was concerned, not that it would come off like the people wouldn't think it was funny, but the people who would be annoyed by it would be perceive it the wrong way, right? Like, I don't mind annoying people who like Nickelback and being like, haha, they have to turn off a setting. But if they perceive it as a money grab instead of a joke, then that would make people a lot more vicious, I think.
They had like charging for any top artist ever to play in the app.
Yeah.
Might work.
And then the alternative was like, okay, well, maybe we make it say it's an in-app purchase, but when you actually buy it, then it's like, oh, okay, fine, you can have it for free.
Just kidding, bud.
Just kidding. We don't actually want your money for Nickelback.
Nobody should have to do that.
So what we were talking about was just the general question of, are people going to burn out on this category of games as a whole? You know, as a society, are we going to look back on it and be like, oh yeah, I remember when everyone used to play like Rock Band all the time. Yeah, that was great. And there's like lots of games like Rock Band and Crash Band and Band Hero and all these sorts of things. And now not as much.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's really hard to say. I mean, gaming trends do happen so often, but it's hard to call this a gaming trend. It's just a marketing trend, but they disappear too. Yeah, it's it's impossible to tell. It's been going pretty strong, and we've seen the mighty fall with like the likes of Zynga, but just different games take their place with different ways to hook you in. I mean, they've gotten more and more simplistic. Candy Crush is just, here's some puzzles, bright colors, things that are cute, done. Their other game, just puppies instead of candy. I don't know if it's going anywhere.
Like I mentioned in passing before, I think the counter example, like certainly Guitar Hero is the example of like, that's how a genre can burn out. I think the best counter example of this kind of grindy gameplay not burning out is casinos, right? Like individual casinos come and go. It's pretty high turnover in sort of the entertainment world. Like there's a reason that when they, you know, when they filmed Ocean's 11, they didn't have any trouble finding a casino to like film the demolition of just for the movie. Cause there's a lot of turnover in that compared to like theme parks or other things in that same kind of sphere. But ultimately like people keep going back for that kind of stuff. And the same kind of like hit of endorphins model of gameplay, like that's what casinos are all about, and that's what these kinds of games are all about. And there doesn't really seem any sign that we as a civilization on the whole will burn out on something that's that fundamental to the way our brains operate.
I think one of the other things that casinos have going for it is for one, the chance of luck. So you can feel that kind of, it's more than just like, oh, you're playing the game well, and a lot of, wow, things are really going my way right now. And if you start getting bad luck, you want to get your good luck back. And then there's also cash.
Yeah, this is another thing that blew my mind about that top grossing chart, is there's like a bunch of casino games on there.
Yep.
But like, they're not for real money. Like, I mean, it's literally just like you buy pretend money and then you gamble with that pretend money. And even if you win a whole bunch of pretend money, like all you can do with it is gamble more. Like that just seems insane to me. Like to the degree that gambling is fun, it's really only fun if you're actually gambling for actual money. Like if you've got some real risk on the line of like, you know, I have X amount of money and I can lose it, or maybe I've got this, you know, 1 in 50 chance of winning 50 times what I put in. And like, that's what makes gambling fun, is that risk reward. Like why you would buy imaginary coins to play in imaginary gambling games beyond me.
It's funny that you say that, because there's a like recent research on the way that gambling works in people's brains, which it's obviously kind of a bug in people's brains because it mathematically makes no sense, right? Is that if you have if someone's playing these slot machines, which are like, you've seen the penny slots where you can bet 100 pennies on one roll, and then it's like every single zigzag is a different way you could win?
Yeah.
You've seen those? So those, normally, when you spin 100, you'll win at least one penny back. And so you, this person is pulling this slot, and every time you spend 100 pennies and you win, you know, 27, and then you win 8, and then you win 94, and then you win 180, and then you win 9. And the winning sum of it back actually triggers most of the same like dopamine or whatever that winning a bunch of money does. So people will do those ones where they win some of it back each time way longer, and it's triggering, like it's basically an exploit on the human brain.
Well, that's one of the classic like psychological experiments on conditioning, right? Is that random reward schedules do way better than known reward schedules. Like if you give a rat a lever and every 10th time they hit it, they get a pellet, they'll figure that out pretty quickly. And after they get the pellet, they'll be way less likely to keep hitting it to get the next pellet, because they know it's going to be 9 more hits before they get their pellet. Whereas if you give them a lever that like gives you a pellet with a 1 in 10 chance, but like, you know, 1 in 1,000 times you'll get 3 in a row and so on, the rat will just sit there like leaning on that lever forever, basically, and never get bored of it.
Oh my God, pellets.
That's actually a really good reasoning for why casinos work, and this model might not survive forever in gaming, because the luck factor is exactly that. It's random reward. It's like, whoa, I just hit a big pot, and you're feeling really great, and so you keep trying until you get that feeling again. Whereas in these games, that does kind of happen in the beginning, which gets you locked in, gets you interested, and then they give you kind of random rewards, like, whoa, you unlocked this thing, who knew you could unlock it? But after a while, they run out of those things to give, and you just be like, oh, I leveled up, here's my reward, I've collected the corn, I sold it to the school, or I don't know why Heyday does that, and it's just...
And then it's just paying $9.99 for another chest full of pellets.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, I know there's the pellets, this is my life now, kill me.
So if it's the same, exploiting the same bug in people's brains as a casino, then why are we not regulating it like a casino? Like, why is it, I mean, other than the fact that it's new, which is sort of my guess. And there's been people talk like, oh yeah, the UK actually has taken some steps to try and regulate it, but it seemed to be more than like, let's give Apple a hard time for letting kids buy in-app purchase rather than, you know, actually having some sort of understanding that people are, they're purposely trying to addict people to the pellet lever.
I think it's difficult to prove that. and they're not making you pay to pull the lever all the time. That you can keep pulling the lever throughout the game as much as the game allows you and keep playing the game forever and ever and ever and never actually give them any money. But you want to keep playing right now, or you want to big up to try and get your fix quicker, you will pay money. And that's what they're banking on. It's not saying, hey, you have to pay in order to get this chance to win.
So how do you regulate it then?
Exactly.
Basically, yeah. Have you seen this PokerStars.net thing?
Which thing? Just the site in general?
Well, there's ads everywhere for PokerStars.net.
Oh, I thought there was some specific like article about it or something. Yeah, I've certainly seen the ads for it.
Right. So you've seen the ads for it, but you're not allowed to advertise an online gambling site that's for money. You can only advertise a free one. PokerStars.com is the one for money.
Yeah.
PokerStars.net is the free one that's just completely covered in ads for the one that that you actually want. And you will probably forget what the domain extension was. Like, it should be like PokerStars.biz or .co or something, and then they'll get like 99% failure rate of people trying to type in the domain they advertise, and it'll go to .com instead. Or you'll just Google PokerStars and get the .com version.
I think that's what they're banking on.
That's kind of fiendish, like having... like getting around the advertising regulations by advertising like a domain misspelling.
and yet they, I mean, like what percent, my grandma still doesn't understand what a domain is after like 15 years of using the internet. So I think that chances are she's going to type PokerStars into Google.
If you type, I'm going to see if you type PokerStars into Google, what comes back? PokerStars.com is the top.
Of course.
Oh, yeah, that'll be
I'm sure
yeah.
all their SEO.
Yeah, yeah. So there you go. So PokerStars.net is the number two hit, and PokerStars.com is the number one hit.
What happens if you enter PokerStars.net into Google?
I just did that, and it does actually give you PokerStars.com as the first result.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, wow. That's strong SEO.
PokerStars.com is better ranked for PokerStars.net than PokerStars.net.
I know people who literally are professionals in the web industry who still type URLs into Google instead of the address bar. And I'm pretty sure this is the target audience. These are the kind of, like, there's so many people who would love to play poker online. They find out, whoa, I don't have to go to my buddy's place every Friday. We can just play online all the time, and they'll type PokerStars.net into whatever bar is at the top of their screen or in the middle of their screen because it's their homepage, and end up gambling real money because, hey, why not? They saw that ad once.
As far as I can tell, the Google search for PokerStars.net, not only is PokerStars.com the top result, but there's also an ad for PokerStars.net served along with the result. Like on the right-hand side here, I have an actual ad for PokerStars.net appearing on my Google search results for PokerStars.net.
Maybe they're just trying to flood out any competition. Like, we know you're trying to buy this spot. We got it.
That's actually probably what it is.
Get out of here, Bodog.
So the conclusion then from all that is that we're screwed and that there's nothing we can do. People are going to have their pellet levers, and even if people try to run them out of town, they're just going to send you to pelletleafer.com.
Yeah. They're just going to come back with a fake mustache.
I mean, I think there's a certain amount of that, that it's like, you know, it's like dandelions on your lawn. Like, it's just kind of something that's probably always going to be there. And that as people that like games, we're just going to have to learn to kind of ignore that noise and hope that it's not doing too much damage to the general cause of high quality games. Like that's kind of the most comfort I can take from it, is going back to that idea of, you know, maybe it's not actually stealing players or stealing money from more worthy causes. It's just another thing. You know, it's like being worried about, about television competing with live theater or something like that. Like it's different markets, hopefully. And that's, you know, it's about the best we can hope for, I think.
It's reality TV compared to Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
That's actually a really good example.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much more crummy reality TV than there is like high quality shows like your Breaking Bad or The Wire or stuff like that. But it doesn't stop the good shows from getting made. It just means you need to be smarter about them. And that's something that seems to be like, even as reality shows have risen, like TV's gotten better. Like a weekly drama kind of show before the reality TV revolution was generally not as high quality as the kind of stuff you can get today. And I don't think those two are related particularly. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it's different forces that are creating that, you know, the reality stars is this kind of catering to the lowest common denominator, like slowing down the look at the traffic accident kind of sense that they're exploiting in people. Whereas the rise of quality hour long dramas probably got more to do with the fact that people have got PVRs now and can afford to commit to the run of a show rather than have to worrying about what happens if they miss an episode. But the fact that the two trends happened at the same time at least demonstrates that they're not in conflict, that it's not a case of like poor entertainment forcing out quality entertainment just by existing, that as long as the trends are different, trends are working in favor of both of them, you can see a rise in both crummy entertainment and quality entertainment at the same time.
And so we have Clash of Clans and The Last of Us existing at the same time.
Indeed.
Optimism.
But there's no Last of Us on iOS yet. That's, you know.
Exactly. And there's no...
I mean, that's the market we're talking about here, right, is iOS games. And we still haven't had our BioShock or Last of Us, I feel.
And there's no Breaking Bad on TLC.
Yeah, no, that's true.
The Life Channel.
So, yeah, I mean, that's, I think, the cynical kind of worst-case scenario is, even if the markets are different and even if the, you know, the hardcore game quality experience kind of market has legs left in it in the face of this competition, like maybe iOS isn't the place for it. Like, that, I'd be kind of sad about that because I like it as a platform, but, you know, ultimately, I hope that's the worst case scenario, is just that iOS turns out to be the TLC of gaming, that the economics of the platform can only support the kind of crummy experiences and you have to go somewhere else. And, you know, hopefully at least that other place will exist in the future. You know, there were people that were sort of down on like, oh, is the new console generation going to be forced out by these kind of free to play experiences on mobile? And at least so far that seems to not be happening, right? That the game consoles are still chugging along and hopefully will be for a little while longer.
Well, you're working on an iOS game right now, aren't you, Matt?
Yeah, I am, actually.
Yeah, so is it fighting back, or is it one of the horde?
It's fighting back for sure.
Awesome.
So actually, to put it in some context, we're working on a game that we have funding for, and we started kind of mid last year, at least I did personally, and we worked on it up until the holidays, took a bit of a break, everybody needed a breather, came back and decided we wanted to completely rethink what we were doing. And instead of trying to make a game that is hyper profitable, just make the best game we possibly can. So it's definitely in that fight back mode of let's make a real great gaming experience for mobile devices and see what happens next.
Awesome. Unfortunately, that's often a trade-off you have to, especially in games and all software, but especially in games.
Pretty much.
Is it good or profitable? I think we'll be good today.
Yeah. Profitable later. Maybe. Hopefully.
Yeah, maybe.
Monetize. You got to monetize once you've got the users, right? Isn't that the approach?
That's the Facebook approach.
And the Snapchat approach.
When are they going to do that?
Monetize? I don't know. Probably after someone buys them for $250 billion, and then it's their problem.
Yeah, Snapchat monetized pretty well. Didn't they turn down, or did they get acquired, or did they just turn down some huge acquisition?
They turned down like $3 billion or something like that.
Yeah, I think it was 3 or 3.6, something like that. They turned it down. Yeah.
So they could have monetized pretty well if they'd wanted to.
Yeah, that would be monetization, taking $3.6 billion for an app with no revenue.
Yep.
Unfortunately, those sort of things don't work in the gaming world.
Nope.
We're just going to make a game, and we're going to give it away. It's going to be really fun. We're going to generate ridiculous amount of server costs. It's just going to be heinous. And then someone's going to pay us billions of dollars for the rights to keep maintaining those servers.
We're going to obtain data. People love data.
That is kind of reassuring, I suppose, that something like that has never worked. Like, no one's ever even bothered to try that model in games of, like, collect users and then monetize. Like, even the sort of games that we're talking about, the kind of scuzzy in-app purchase games, like, the buckets of coins are in there from, like, day one.
Do you guys remember Draw Something?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was probably the first and last of that. Hey, what? You have a like quadrillion users on the first like 3 weeks? We're going to buy you for a giant pile of cash. And then a few weeks later, it's like, oh, actually, they all went away. We're going to lay you all off and just be sad.
Yeah, and did they even have their like purchase of additional stuff? Like that was, I think, their monetization thing is like selling additional brushes and stuff like that. That might not even been in the initial versions of it. Like that might have been a once the user base started to come thing.
I'm pretty sure it was at least really early on, because I know I was a pretty early adopter and bought my brushes pretty quickly.
But buying like the brush, it wasn't consumable, right?
No. You just got new colors forever.
Yeah, and that's the whole thing. The kind of trade off that we're talking about is the difference between buying content, which is effectively what that was, versus consumables.
Right, and it comes down to largely it's having a limited gameplay versus having the entire gameplay or the entire experience. And that's the same concept that works with light versions of games and demos. And it's technically what all free games do, except usually I shouldn't say all free games, because most of them are just premium currency. You can get the full experience without spending money. But games where the in-app purchase is content, you can extend your experience by paying for it. Like The Walking Dead, the first episode is free, the next four you have to pay for. It's try before you buy, really.
Yeah, that's an interesting point on this stuff, is the fact that there isn't really any demo culture on iOS really does drive people into the like make something free and then make you buy something more model, because it's tough to get mind share without that, right? You don't have the ability to sort of have a demo that's tied into your application in any way other than that. You can have a separate light and regular version, but then you're sort of, you know, you don't have all your like all your power behind one product, right? You've got essentially two apps that are sort of unrelated from the point of view of you know, like their app store URL and stuff like that, and which charts they're appearing on and so on. And so I think people are kind of pressured into, even if they want to be cool about it, like they say, all right, we got to give people something for free. So we make a game, we give it away for free, and then charge them for something else. And once they're like once they're in that trap, then it's like, all right, well, it turns out that, yeah, we thought that charging them for like extra missions was going to be good, but it turns out that really it's charging them for bags of coins that makes all the money. So it pushes them in that direction.
Yeah. And I mean, like apps like Letterpress and Tall Chest have tried to kind of, all right, you can play this game, but if you want the full experience, there's an in-app purchase to pull down the paywall, essentially. So in Letterpress, have more than five games, and in Tall Chest, I think it's have more than one. But that kind of thing, yeah, it didn't take off very well because you can't really explain it before getting into it. So the people, it's an interesting struggle, and it clearly didn't work all that well if almost nobody's doing it.
Well, I think it works well for something like Letterpress, where you have one person like Lauren Brichter who wants to make something great, and you know, he spent a few months on it, and then he shipped it, and then he wants to make enough back that he can work on the next thing. It's very different if you have, you know, a team of 4 to 10 to 20, depending on how big a studio you are. A lot of indie game studios that needs to actually maintain a bunch of servers and needs to have an art team like Letterpress. You know, the art assets are not exactly very time consuming to create. So he's got his icon there, which is nice. But so the total cost of putting that together is low enough that doing something that's a user friendly, a player friendly scheme like that, I think is a lot more feasible.
Yeah, definitely. I can agree with that.
That being said, I wish that you could do, like, if we could have AAA games where you could put $100 million into making it and then have a humane way of having us be able to try it out. And then if we like it and we're playing it more, get a reasonable amount of payback for that, that would be awesome.
Yeah. And I think with like just putting that kind of concept in front of players, you have to be really delicate with it. I think in-app purchases works is the reason it works is because it's, I don't want to say it's unobtrusive because it's usually right there, but it's not mandatory generally. And it just kind of pushes you. It's like, hey, you can do this if you want, but you can keep playing, quote unquote. Whereas with this model, it kind of halts you in your tracks and says, stop, this is the end of your gaming experience unless you pay us. And until that becomes ingrained in the culture that it's like, oh, this is what games do, then it's going to be tough to actually pull that off without seeming like rate us on Instagram style maddening.
5 stars now.
Yeah, maybe they lock the content unless you give them 5 stars.
God help us if they ever figure out a way to figure out how many stars you rated them.
Oy.
Yeah, that would be pretty brutal if there was ever an API call for doing that. There's probably some way if you were cunning enough and had like low enough turnover on ratings that you could like scrape the page for the number of reviews that.
Well, you know, actually you could, because it's a few hours delay, but if you were able to keep the user authenticated, keep track of the fact that they claim to have left a review, and then you could maybe intuit what their username was, or, and you know what country they're in.
We're going to cut all this stuff out, right? Like, we don't want to give them any ideas.
Yeah,
we don't want to be solving this problem that if there are any people who work for Zynga listening.
Don't worry, I'll cut it all out. All right, you guys want to button it up?
Sure.
Sure.
Unless anybody has something they really want us to mention.
Yeah, I think we got a good show.
Sounds good to me.
All right.
Yeah. All right. Cue theme music. This is the theme music right now.
Nice.
Silence.
It's 8-bit. It has all sorts of cool bleeps and bloops.
I can move my mic back over close to the wall and get the RF interference.
That would be
again.
Great.
Use that as our theme music.
Do you have like an outro, like a talkie outro at all?
That's a good question.
Like thanks for being on the show. And as always,
yeah,
enter.
That's a good question. I should do something like that.
Yeah.
I should thank you guys for being on the show. I don't know. If Nigel's going to be on every show, do I thank him every time? I feel like I should.
Yeah, may as well.
Yeah. Thanks to Nigel Brook and Matt Kumpf for joining us on Up, Up, Down, Down.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it was awesome.
You can get the show notes at upup.fm or follow us on Twitter at upupshow.
And hey, why not subscribe?
And why not subscribe? It's going to be great.
And leave us a rating in iTunes. Our scraper bots are standing by to verify that you've rated us 5 stars.
Yeah, if you don't rate it 5 stars, you can't keep listening to the podcast. Okay, now the music runs. We're pros already.
Yeah.
Awesome. Do you have anything you can share about the game that you're working on other than sort of that you're fighting back, or is it still kind of in rethink phase?
Oh, no, it's we've got a pretty clear direction. That's what we wanted to do, is the direction. Like, none of us were really excited about the game because we didn't really know what it was. We knew it was like an espionage hacker game. It's being a spiritual successor to the first. And we knew that it was taking place in kind of a, what's the word?
Dystopian.
Yeah, like surveillance state. That was what I was trying to think of.
Ah, yes.
And there's this system called Spectrum, which is kind of an analogous to Prism, although ironic, a lot of these ideas came out before this was that any of that stuff was leaked.
And that's good though. Like, that's, you want to be on the leading edge of trends like that, right? Like, every screenwriter who's like sitting now, like, oh, I'm gonna write this awesome like espionage spying script, right? You know, in like 6 months, the movie studios are just gonna be like, this is ridiculous. We have like 80 of these scripts. Whereas if you've already got the thing in development, you know, then you can like, all right, go now. The thing's just hot. So that's where you want to be, is on the leading edge of those kinds of trends.
Yeah, well, there's that Watch Dogs game that was a sort of hacking espionage game that was previewed, like, I don't know, a few months before the whole Prism thing broke.
Yeah.
And now they're just like, oh my God, let's ship this. It's going to be perfect. Yeah.
I think that's going to be pretty huge on cashing in on that. I guess it looks like a really good game, too, from what I've seen of it. I know a couple people that are working on that. A couple people from Radical went to Montreal and are at Ubisoft Montreal working on that now. So,
actually, speaking about the topical nature of it, that's actually a huge part of what we're trying to do, because all the missions are populated and pushed through a server that we control. So we can write a new mission in an hour, so and push it to all devices or anybody who's, you know, completed prerequisites. So we can make like Rob Ford crack video on the day that gets leaked and just change names and make it like, oh my God, this is actually relevant. Or we can just target that to Toronto because it's a location based game and be like, oh, if these people are in Toronto, yeah, we can make this kind of interesting game that's clearly a parody on what's really happening. And it feels relevant to them personally, while fitting within the storyline and the context of the game. And that's what we're really trying to push with this, because the technology really, really affords for it. So yeah, it should be, if that works, it's going to be pretty cool.
Not to get too far into the games, but is the like hacking sort of the fundamental gameplay mechanic? Is it some sort of like spatial puzzly kind of thing, or is it actually more of like a character like wander around doing stuff kind of game, and the hacking's kind of window dressing for it?
It's definitely the hacking, like it's a story game primarily, like it's story driven and item driven, and power ups and stuff. And the hacking, actually hacking into places, is easy. You just do it. And it's just a matter of time or power, based on how much you've leveled up. There's strategy involved in what you hack, how difficult it is to hack. Do you know what content's inside it already? You can use your power-ups to like make places easier to hack or prevent yourself from getting detected. And then there's these things that are currently called dead drops, but that's just a legacy from the previous game, where you can add buffs to a specific location that you know you're going to be constantly going to make hacking there easier or more valuable to you. And then you can, that's how you get like quest items and learn information about like people that you're trying to get information on, and develop the story and meet with your kind of co-conspirators, other members of the resistance against the surveillance state, without actually meeting them in real life, because that's impossible for us.
I just posted Matt's teaser from Dribble into chat, so you can see what it looks like. I saw hexagons and I just knew I would immediately like it, because any game that's like, oh, you have hexagons? I'm like, yes, this is my game.
I'm glad, because I've been working on this for a while, and making a game map out of a real world map is super difficult, because things just want to be on top of each other because things are really close. Then you have to use algorithms to be like, oh, let's not do that, but what if we're hiding something important and we have to calculate what level you're at? So in order to combat that, I'm like, well, what if I just lock them to a grid? And then it feels, as soon as I did that, I'm like, oh, it's a game now. And it actually makes sense. And it really helps in like, for the things like the buffs and anything that has an area of effect, I can actually calculate it based on these grid points instead of meters. Yeah, it's feeling a lot better now. And it looks way better than the first game. So that's why they hired me. They didn't have a graphic designer for the first game. It was just done by them. There's three.
It looks
three
awesome.
Guys.
We'll put that in the show notes.
Oh, cool. Thanks. Yeah, should be fun. Fingers crossed. It's feeling fun now. We're gonna try and have beta. I think we have to have beta. Personal Vendetta in 10 weeks. So,
all right, awesome.
We cool. shall see. That's depending on whether or not we sign on contract work too. So, yeah,
it's always kind of the way that goes.
Yeah.
Welcome to the world of indie development.
Yay.